KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump said just weeks ago that tariffs were economic medicine. Now he's saying the current 145% tax on Chinese goods will have to come down. Is there an actual policy change on the way? We'll ask on Morning Edition from NPR News. The administration is working to make it easier to drill on federal lands. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. We go to New Mexico, where oil executives are not sure that's enough to drive their profits higher. Also, tips for people in default on their student loans. And why is soccer star Cristiano Ronaldo in the latest edition of a classic 90s fighting game? It's Thursday, April 24th. 35 years ago today, a new window to the universe opened as the Hubble telescope launched into space. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. China says there are no talks underway with the United States about trade. Beijing says any reports saying so are false. This comes after President Trump said there's been direct contact between China and the U.S. every day. NPR's John Ruich reports from Shanghai.
China's Foreign Ministry and Commerce Ministry both issued unequivocal statements. Commerce Ministry spokesperson He Yadong said there were, quote, absolutely no negotiations between the two sides. And Foreign Ministry spokesman Guo Jiakun echoed that at a daily news conference. He said, as far as he knows, there have been no consultations or negotiations over tariffs, let alone any agreement. Trump said this week that he expects tariffs on China, now at 145%, to come down substantially. And he suggested that negotiations with Beijing are actively underway. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was reported to have said on Tuesday talks had not begun. Foreign Ministry spokesman Guo said the door is open to dialogue, but it must be based on equality, mutual respect, and reciprocity. John Ruich, NPR News, Shanghai.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi says his country will find the attackers who killed 26 people this week. Most victims were Hindu men. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Mumbai. Indian officials are blaming Pakistan, which denies responsibility.
Modi said India would find and punish, quote, every terrorist, their handlers, their backers. The attack outraged many Indians, not just for the scale of the killing, but the context. Gunmen attacked tourists in a meadow, turning a scenic attraction into a killing field. They targeted men. Eyewitnesses told local media that gunmen asked if they were Muslims before killing them. The group which claimed responsibility for the attack is seen as a proxy for the Pakistani military. On Wednesday, India said it was suspending its decades-old water treaty with Pakistan. Pakistani officials say the attack was a pretext by India to deny the country water. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
In the U.S., the National Institutes of Health plans to include private health information in a study of rising rates of autism spectrum disorder. NPR's John Hamilton reports the study is part of a larger federal effort to find the causes of autism.
NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya says the agency will create a national database of autistic people, then look for factors that might have contributed to their diagnosis. The effort will use data from private doctors and insurance companies, as well as government health programs. One goal is to identify environmental exposures that could cause autism. But Dr. David Mandel of the University of Pennsylvania says that's unlikely.
The exposure is probably in utero, and it looks like we're studying children after they're born.
There's also concern that sensitive private information used in the study could become public. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. President Trump has issued a rare rebuke of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Writing online, Trump says he's not happy with Russia's overnight drone and missile attacks on Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. At least 8 Ukrainians have been killed and more than 70 wounded. Trump says, quote, Vladimir, stop. Trump goes on to say, let's get the peace deal done. Just yesterday, Trump was blaming Ukraine's president for standing in the way of a U.S.-backed peace deal. President Trump's win last November was seen initially as benefiting other populist political candidates around the world. But as NPR's Scott Newman reports, Upcoming elections in Canada and Australia are suggesting those countries may see different election results.
3 months ago, Canadian opposition leader Pierre Poilievre's message of tax cuts, downsizing government, and fighting woke ideology looked certain to propel his conservatives to a historic win in Monday's election. But President Trump's unpopular tariffs and talk of annexing Canada have helped Prime Minister Mark Carney's Liberal Party stage a turnaround. Simra Sevi is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Toronto.
So in 3 months, that's a major shift in Canadian politics.
Australia's opposition leader Peter Dutton is seeing a similar backlash to his homegrown version of MAGA. He faces voters in May. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
Pope Francis continues to lie in state at St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican. He died Monday at the age of 88. Vatican officials say at least 50,000 mourners have viewed his casket. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump is singing a slightly different tune when it comes to tariffs on China.
Here he is speaking with reporters at the White House yesterday.
We are going to have a fair deal with China. It's going to be fair.
The president's high tariffs have sparked a trade war between the world's two largest economies. And while it's not clear Trump is actually changing policy yet, he is changing his tone.
To help us sort this out, we're joined now by NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid. Asma, good morning.
Good morning.
So what at this point is the White House saying about tariffs on China?
Well, this week we've heard the president and some of his top economic advisors acknowledge that the high tariff rates are not a sustainable long-term dynamic. And, you know, just to remind folks where we are at this point, Beijing has a 125% tariff on American goods. This was, of course, in response to a 145% tariff rate that the Trump administration put on Chinese goods. On Tuesday, the president told reporters that that rate is going to come down substantially.
145% is very high. And it won't be that high. It's not going to be that high. It got up to there. We were talking about fentanyl where, you know, various elements built it up to 145. No, it won't be anywhere near that high.
No, he did not give an actual number. And frankly, even if the tariff rate comes down by double digits, you're still looking at rates that are unprecedented in our lifetime.
Does this really seem like a shift after all this kind of tit for tat, back and forth escalation around this?
I mean, it is. And there's really two main reasons for the shift. This tariff rate, you know, if they remain in place, they would virtually bring trade between China and the U.S. to a halt. But this is also fundamentally, Michelle, about the stock market and the economic uncertainty that Trump's tariffs have created. You know, Trump initially acknowledged that there could be some sort of short-term economic pain, but that it would be worth it. And now you hear his team boasting that they're striking deals, that they're in conversation with some 90 countries. The Treasury Secretary was also out there this week trying to quiet market jitters. And on a somewhat related note, the president also tried to alleviate fears that he himself had stoked last week when he suggested that he would get rid of Fed Chair Jerome Powell.
No, I have no intention of firing him. I would like to see him be a little more active in terms of his idea to lower interest rates.
But ultimately, Michelle, I mean, much of the economic focus has been on tariffs, and specifically when it comes to China, the president has been softening his tough posturing. He said this week he's not going to play hardball with China's President Xi Jinping.
Okay, so let's talk more about China. Is this just a change in rhetoric, or do we see an actual change in policy?
I mean, we're not seeing any change in policy yet, despite the optimism that President Trump is projecting. China is, of course, one of the U.S.'s biggest trading partners. Anna Ashton was with the U.S.-China Business Council for years. And so yesterday I called her up. I wanted to get guidance on this all. And I asked her, you know, what is the off-ramp here? And she did not sound optimistic.
I don't think that the combination of constant threats and then wild swings in terms of how committed the White House is to those threats is likely to bring Xi Jinping to the table to negotiate a real truce.
The president told reporters this week that if his administration cannot reach a deal with China, they'll just set a number unilaterally, by which he means they will set a tariff rate on their own.
That is NPR's Asma Khalid. Thanks, Asma.
Good to speak with you.
So we've talked about these twists and turns in policy. Now let's ask about what may be the politics behind these course changes. Alex Conant is a Republican political strategist and founding partner of Firehouse Strategies. Previously, he was communications director for former Senator, now Secretary of State, Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So President Trump made it clear that these tariffs are or were a big priority for him. Now he's saying tariffs on Chinese imports could come down, not to zero, though. But through all this, you know, investors, American business owners, consumers have all been expressing alarm about how this is affecting them. Is this what President Trump is reacting to, and why?
I think he's reacting to a couple of things, and I actually think it's pretty simple. Whenever the president is going to ask the American people to make great sacrifice, as he is with the tariffs, you know, Americans are hearing about potential shortages at grocery stores and department stores this fall, higher prices. If Americans are going to do that, they have to have a clear understanding of why. And the reasons for the tariffs that we've heard from the White House are very varied. We've heard it's for deficit reduction. We've heard it to bring manufacturing jobs back. We've heard it to put leverage on other countries to make great trade deals. All these things cannot be true at the same time. So I think there's confusion as to why Americans are being asked to make these sorts of sacrifices. Couple that with the pummeling in the stock market that we've seen, the rise in bonds, and then political fallout amongst Republicans. If you look at poll numbers, the tariffs are less popular amongst Republicans than many of the president's other policies. And you've seen a lot of concern from Republican members of Congress. This is not sustainable. And I think the Treasury Secretary conceded that earlier this week when he said that the current level of tariffs on China is not sustainable.
So too many different explanations doesn't necessarily make sense to the average American, and the White House thinks that he has an advantage on economic policy and he can't afford to lose that.
Yeah, that's right. And we've seen his poll numbers start to dip on the economy throughout his political career. His standing on the economy has been his bedrock. If we see that begin to erode, he's in real political damage, okay. Real political danger.
Okay. So in contrast, let's talk about immigration. The administration has faced a lot of judicial pushback. Two judges have extended temporary blocks in the administration's use of the Alien Enemies Act to expedite mass deportations. The Supreme Court has told the administration to facilitate the return of this man mistakenly reported to El Salvador. But unlike the tariff issue, the administration seems to be doubling down. What do you think explains the difference here?
I think the administration feels like they're on much stronger ground politically here. You know, the stock market doesn't care as much about immigration. His poll numbers amongst Republicans, even independents on immigration, are much stronger than they are on tariffs. So this is clearly the issue that they want to be talking about. Understand that they have some real legal issues on this, and they may end up losing in court. And I think if they do lose in court, the public, including Republicans in the latest poll numbers, will want them to respect those court orders. Mm. But I think it's a fight that the administration welcomes at this time, because immigration has always been a winning issue for Trump.
Does the administration want these actions to go to court so even if they lose, they can say they went to the mat?
I think that they really want to test the president's powers in court and see what they can get away with. I mean, I think that they hope to expand what he's able to do through executive actions on immigration. And even if they don't win all the fights, if they win some, I think they'll take that win.
Is there a point at which this becomes toxic, though? I mean, there's some new polling data that shows that, you know, widespread and mostly bipartisan sentiment, but the White House should obey court orders. Is there a tipping point here where it just...
Yeah.
Just doing the most starts to backfire.
Well, I think if the courts, especially the Supreme Court, rules that the president can't do something, he really does need to abide by that or face serious political backlash from Republicans, including Republicans in Congress.
The last issue I wanted to get to, the president's fight with Harvard, among other, you know, elite universities, but, you know, mainly Harvard right now. The university is suing the government for freezing this funding. Do these attacks on higher educations make for good, higher education institutions make for good politics?
I think there's a lot of unease or unhappiness with higher education in America. And so I think the president is directionally right in trying to pick fights, trying to reform higher education. I think the executive order he did yesterday targeting the accreditation system is a step in the right direction and something that Americans probably would support. But I do think that there's a lot of unease, including amongst Republicans, again, with the federal government trying to put private institutions into some sort of federal receivership, dictating how private institutions should act, what they should teach. Because, look, we won't always have a Republican president in the White House, and I don't think we want Democrats doing the same thing in the future.
That's Alex Conant. He's a GOP strategist with Firehouse Strategies. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
More young people are developing colorectal cancer. That's cancer that originates in the colon or rectum. According to research published in the journal Nature yesterday, a harmful bacteria could be the reason why. Here's NPR's Will Stone.
It's unclear why colon cancer cases have doubled in people under 55 over the past two decades. But part of the story could be colibactin. It's known as a genotoxin, and it's made by certain strains of E. coli and other bacteria. Ludmil Alexandrov is a researcher at the University of California, San Diego.
You can think of it as the weapon system of a bacteria. You know, they need to fight other bacteria. They need to defend themselves.
They do this by damaging DNA. And the thinking goes, this colibactin weaponry sometimes gets directed at our own gut cells.
And they may end up actually causing colorectal cancer.
Scientists can look for mutations in colon cancer, signs that colibactin did the damage, and they find them in about 15% of cases. But when Alexandrov and a team of scientists analyzed samples from nearly 1,000 patients all over the world, they discovered that number is actually much higher in younger people.
The thing that we very strikingly saw is that if we look at people, let's say, under the age of 40, and we compare them to people over the age of 70, they're going to have 3 to 5 times more mutations.
And through some detective work, Alexandrov says they could tell bacteria release the toxins in the gut of these cancer patients when they were kids.
Our estimate is that it happens within the first 10 years of life.
And that puts people on track to develop cancer maybe in their 20s or 30s instead of later in life. The research can't prove this is what caused early onset colon cancer in the patients, but it's a strong association. Christiane Jobin, a microbiome researcher at the University of Florida, says it builds on years of research, including experiments in animals showing this genotoxin, colibactin, can drive cancer. Of course, the big question here is why.
What triggers this weapon or the deployment? We don't know. These E. coli have been there for eons. It's not new. We're not infected. We've been transmitting this E. coli for a long time.
Around 20 or 30% of people have these strains of E. coli in their gut. But in some people, something about our modern environment, lifestyle, diet, and other factors, is causing these microbes to behave differently. Alexandrov speculates it could be the mode of birth, breastfeeding, even antibiotics. And it's not just E. coli. Jobin says there are likely other bacteria and genotoxins involved.
I don't think colorectal cancer is caused by a single bacteria producing one genotoxin.
That, he says, would be too simple. Will Stone, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the mystery of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. While millions of Americans have the diagnosis and are treated with stimulants, there is no scientific consensus about the biological roots of the condition and some medical concerns about common treatments. We'll talk about the latest research with journalist Paul Tuff. Join us. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool, customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. A dozen Democratic state attorneys general are taking the Trump administration to court over the trade war. Here's Cameron Sanchez from member station KJZZ in Phoenix.
The attorneys general filed suit on Wednesday, arguing that President Trump's worldwide tariffs are arbitrary and the power to impose them lies with Congress, not the executive branch. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays is co-leading the lawsuit. She says although the president can create tariffs in emergencies, Trump isn't operating under those conditions.
This is not business as usual. This is a necessary response to an administration that continues to operate far outside the bounds of the law and the Constitution.
At the core of the lawsuit is what the attorneys general argue is a lack of justification. The only reason they say Trump is imposing tariffs is because he disapproves of the United States buying more from other countries than they buy from us. The tariff lawsuit asks the U.S. Court of International Trade to strike down four of the president's executive orders. A White House spokesperson told the New York Times that the tariff lawsuit is a, quote, witch hunt by Democrats against President Trump. Mays, like many of the Democratic AGs, is already involved in several lawsuits against Trump's administration.
We are facing an unprecedented and lawless presidency, one that has made a habit over the last 3 months of disregarding the separation of powers and ignoring the two other co-equal branches of government.
The attorneys general argue that not only are the tariffs illegal, but they will also sharply raise the cost of living for American families. For NPR News, I'm Cameron Sanchez in Phoenix.
Gamers, you probably already know the classic video game series Fatal Fury. It's filled with super-powered martial arts fighters. Now these video game warriors are teaming up with an odd cast of real-world characters, including a celebrity athlete and a Swedish DJ. But there's a controversy about this new release, and it goes a lot deeper than whether the game is cool to play. NPR's Lindsay Toddy has the backstory.
It's been over 25 years since the last Fatal Fury game was released, so fans were excited when a new title, Fatal Fury City of the Wolves, was revealed. But last month, the Japanese video game developer SNK announced a brand new character.
He's an icon, a legend, and now a fighter.
That new fighter is the global soccer star Cristiano Ronaldo. What's a real-life soccer player doing in a martial arts fighting game? Kicking flaming soccer balls into people's faces, of course.
He shoots!
Not long after, another celebrity guest fighter, Salvatore Ganacci, was announced. He's a Bosnian-Swedish DJ known for his viral videos. He's bringing beatdowns as well as beats.
I'm from Bosnia, take me to America.
Michael Townsend talks about fighting games on his YouTube channel, Ruffelmonger. He says Ronaldo, with his more than 600 million followers on Instagram, is bringing in potential new fans.
I've already seen many people who would otherwise have not had any interest in the game say because their favorite players in the game, they're going to buy the game.
To understand how this collaboration even happened, we have to get into the business side of things. Over the past few years, shares of the game's developer, SNK, have been bought up by a nonprofit called the MISC Foundation, also known as the Mohammed bin Salman Foundation, as in the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Cristiano Ronaldo plays for a Saudi soccer team owned by the Saudi royal family, and Salvatore Ganacci, the DJ, has performed at Saudi sporting events, and so the wheels of synergy began to turn. Kristen Diwan is a senior resident scholar with the Arab Gulf States Institute. She says it's all part of an investment strategy by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
There's a big push towards sports and entertainment and to these more creative fields.
Almost a decade ago, Saudi Arabia started a massive project called Saudi Vision 2030. The country is planning cities and real estate developments with bright new entertainment districts to attract tourists, such as Qiddiya City.
Qiddiya City, leveraging the power of play, where entertainment, sports, and culture converge.
Diwan says all this is a way for Saudi Arabia to diversify its economy so that it's not so reliant on oil. Part of that, Diwan says, requires changing Saudi Arabia's image.
They really need people to move to the kingdom. They need to attract the biggest talent. You can't do that if people still have the old image of Saudi Arabia, which was, to be fair, a very closed society.
But changing Saudi Arabia's image will be a challenge. The kingdom has been denounced by multiple international organizations for its human rights record. In 2021, the CIA determined that Mohammed bin Salman ordered the assassination of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And inside the kingdom, same-sex relationships are punishable by the death penalty. I talked to a fighting game fan who blogs under the name Tanner J at his website, Them's Fighting Words. He says that the Qiddiya Investment Company has been paying top dollar for sponsorship deals at gaming events in the U.S., and he's been critical of the organizations that take that money.
The amount of LGBT people that have made up parts of the fighting game community, have been innovators, have been large personalities, is such that I believe you could almost use the word betrayal to partner up very closely with this project.
And Tanner J says, if the hope is that Cristiano Ronaldo can help improve Saudi Arabia's image, that plan may backfire. Ronaldo has faced allegations of rape. He has denied the accusations. No formal charges have been filed. But while Tanner J criticizes Saudi Vision 2030, he's not calling for a boycott of the new Fatal Fury game.
I don't believe necessarily a consumption of the product itself is an endorsement of the Saudi Arabian project, in the same way that, say, I don't believe putting oil in your car is an endorsement of Saudi Aramco, which is their big oil production company.
And Michael Townsend says he'll continue to cover Fatal Fury on his YouTube channel.
The games are still the games to me. Maybe the people at the top are different, but I'm still here for the games I love growing up, you know?
We reached out to SNK, the MISC Foundation, and representatives for Cristiano Ronaldo, and have not heard back. Lindsay Totty, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Filmmaker Isaiah Saxon grew up exploring redwood forests and looking out for Sasquatch.
You think that you're seeing things and you think that you might be one step away from the great magical experience.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Isaiah Saxon has filmed The Legend of Ochi and the Magic of Nature on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Authorities in Ukraine's capital are still searching for people who might be trapped in rubble following Russia's large-scale missile and drone attack overnight. The assault killed more than a half dozen people and leveled at least one apartment building. NPR's Joanna Kakissis is in Kyiv.
The Ukrainian military says Russia launched 215 drones and missiles at Ukraine, most aimed at Kyiv, in one of the deadliest strikes on the capital. In a video post on social media, Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said rescue workers were digging survivors out with their bare hands. Once again, we are seeing the face of Russian peace, he said with sarcasm. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he's cutting short a trip to South Africa to return to Kyiv. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
The attack also injured dozens of people. The Vatican says more than 60,000 people have paid their respects to Pope Francis at St. Peter's Basilica. The Pope's body is lying in state for 3 days ahead of his funeral on Saturday. President Trump will be among world leaders attending the service in St. Peter's Square. China's foreign ministry denies Beijing is talking to the U.S. about tariffs, as President Trump indicates. This is NPR News. Democratic attorneys general in 12 states are suing President Trump, arguing only Congress has the power to impose tariffs. The states include Arizona, Illinois, and New York. The Secret Service has released a study examining the gunman who killed more than two dozen people at a church in Texas nearly 8 years ago. Paul Flav with Texas Public Radio says the study highlights the assailant's long history of sexual and domestic violence.
Devin Kelly, who killed 26 people and injured 22 at the First Baptist Church of Sutherland Springs, had received a domestic violence conviction in an Air Force court-martial and had been accused of sexual violence against women and girls multiple times. Secret Service researcher Joshua Ryan says 41% of all mass shooters have a history of domestic violence.
So these findings highlight an important link that exists between domestic violence and mass casualty violence that occurs in our communities.
The Sutherland Springs shooting resulted in the Defense Department being ordered to pay out hundreds of millions of dollars to victims over its failures to report Kelly's felony to the FBI. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Kelly took his own life after attacking that church. Later today, the state of Alabama is scheduled to execute a death row inmate convicted of capital murder. The 55-year-old inmate admits he raped and killed a woman in 2010. He'll be put to death by lethal injection. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Trump administration is restarting collections on defaulted student loans. Borrowers in default still have time to act before the government potentially seizes money from tax refunds, Social Security benefits, and eventually wages. Here's NPR's Rachel Treisman.
The Department of Education announced this week that on May 5th, it will begin collections on federal student loans that have gone into default. That means borrowers haven't made a payment in at least 270 days. For millions, though, it's been a lot longer than that.
Anyone who's in default on a federal student loan today would have been in default pre-COVID.
Betsy Mayotte runs the nonprofit Institute of Student Loan Advisors. The Education Department said Monday that more than 5 million borrowers have been in default since the first Trump administration paused debt collection in March 2020, when the pandemic hit. The Biden administration continued that pause, even after it restarted student loan payments in 2023. 5 years later, Mayotte says, it was only a matter of time until the government restarted collections, no matter who won the White House.
Department of Education has a requirement to collect on these debts. They're owed to the U.S. taxpayer.
The department plans to warn affected borrowers in the coming weeks of this return to collections. It says an additional 4 million are in late stage delinquency and could be months or even weeks away from default. Mike Pierce of the Student Borrower Protection Center says borrowers can check their status by logging into studentaid.gov.
We would encourage everybody at this moment, if you've been disengaged from your student loans, especially going back before the pandemic, to just see what you owe and who you owe it to.
There are two ways to get out of default, besides repaying loans in full up front. The fastest is to consolidate loans and agree to new repayment terms, but that won't get the default off your record. The way to do that is by rehabilitating the loan by making 9 on-time consecutive payments.
The federal student loan program is probably one of the most flexible programs that exists when you borrow money.
Scott Buchanan, head of the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, says borrowers need to know. If they're in financial hardship, there are ways to lower their monthly payments. Plus, they can change repayment plans as their circumstances change. Buchanan says borrowers have lots of options, and they're all better than default. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
The Interior Department says it's fast-tracking approvals for oil, gas, coal, and mineral projects on federal land, cutting down environmental reviews from years to weeks. Oil and gas executives expected President Trump's return to the White House would make things easier, but optimism for higher profits has started to fade. As part of a series on how Trump's early policies are playing out across America, NPR's Kirk Sigler reports from northwestern New Mexico.
The San Juan Basin is this huge swath of barren brown desert that first boomed in the 1950s when the federal government opened it to speculators and oilmen seeing green dollar signs. Some 40,000 wells now pockmark the rolling high desert hills of the Four Corners, many still reliably pumping up light sweet crude and natural gas through the old iconic pump jacks, this one named Poppin' Johnny. This basin has struggled lately as the major international companies left to drill on private land in southern New Mexico, Texas, North Dakota.
The first part is the wellhead.
Today, it's the smaller independents like Sean Dugan still hanging on. He's the young and cheerful third-generation owner of Dugan Production in Farmington.
Are you guys here until you're done?
He sees potential for another boom out here. There's still a lot of natural gas left beneath us, and the hope is all the new data centers being built down in Phoenix will need cheaper gas-powered electricity. But then he smirks, watching men in grubby overalls move huge, long steel pipes.
Your poly pipe, which is what these pipelines are made out of now, that all comes from the Asian markets.
Dugan says the cost of doing business out here was already expensive, and President Trump's trade war is making it worse.
And so it's like now you're checking the tariff rate. You wake up, check the tariff rate.
He used to spend $80,000 on a load of these pipes from Korea. Now he figures it could be up to $120,000. Dugan wants to plan for 10 years out, but now he doesn't know what's happening tomorrow.
It just kneecaps you when all this uncertainty and volatility is in the air.
I think the whole tariff thing is going to backfire on Trump.
George Sharp is the investment manager for Marion Oil and Gas, one of the San Juan Basin's oldest operators.
You know, Trump's drill baby drill and lower oil prices are not simpatico.
In other words, he says, if Trump tanks the economy and oil prices hover at or below the cost of production, you can remove all the regulatory barriers you want, but companies aren't going to drill new wells.
Build, baby, build. You know, they want manufacturing to be built here in the U.S. Well, there's not a manufacturing center that exists here in the U.S. that doesn't have a supply chain that's worldwide.
Trump lost New Mexico, but he did rack up big wins in rural counties like this. Sharp and others here do hope the Build Baby Build push will make it easier to get a new gas pipeline built from here to Mexico. The mayor of Farmington told me the America First energy agenda has brought renewed optimism to his town, built atop one of the richest gas and coal fields in the U.S. On the day Trump issued four new executive orders to revive America's coal industry, I'm riding with local environmentalist Dave Fosdick to the top of a hogback for what turns out to be a bit of an apocalyptic view.
So here we are up on top. Four Corners Power Plant, about 11 o'clock, and then San Juan Generating Station off to our left at 9 o'clock.
The enormous San Juan coal plant, currently being dismantled, is a hulking gash of twisted metal and steel glaring in the desert sun. And that Four Corners plant on the Navajo Nation is supposed to be decommissioned in 2031, but Trump has promised to stop coal plants from closing. People here are tired of seeing Farmington in the headlines as a town that's depopulating.
There's opportunities, but it's hard. It's hard to find an area like this that has been so dependent on oil and gas trying to transition to something else.
Farmington has tried to diversify by promoting tourism and outdoor recreation and all this public land around here. But those jobs don't pay nearly as much. And with virtually no new drilling here for now, most of the oil field work is in servicing existing wells, or there's work decommissioning them to prevent the leaking of methane.
Yes, these guys, they're about to start laying down production pipe. Start cleaning the hole and get ready to start pumping cement probably tomorrow.
Alex Prieto is grateful for the job in a time when so much feels uncertain. He's able to stay local and not have to travel to oil patches out of state like in the past.
I love it. Just keep my head busy and I provide for my family, which is the most important thing.
We're happy, Prieto says, as long as we're working. But no one seems to be preparing for a lot of new hiring here at this point, despite promises of a new oil and gas boom on federal land. Kirk Ziegler, NPR News, Farmington, New Mexico.
This is NPR News.
Project in Los Angeles invites you to use a payphone to say goodbye to something or someone. A call for connection next time, here and now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Amy Martinez. After a long week, sometimes a drink with friends is a great way to unwind, even if you're a wild chimp. For the first time, researchers recorded chimps enjoying alcohol together. It was fermented breadfruit. Researchers aren't sure why the chimps share, but I get it. They want to go where chimps know. Chimps are all the same. They want to go where everybody knows their name. If wild chimps have names, it's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. nature.org/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. In Iran, female singers are facing a wave of arrests and harassment. The country's religious government does not permit women to perform alone on stage. Some have found moderate fame anyway by releasing their music on social media. But as Duri Buscarin reports, Iran's authorities have begun tracking them down as well.
Her friends have been arrested while performing at underground shows. Most of her fans can only listen to her music through VPN software that hides the location of their computer. But this artist keeps making music.
We should all know that music is not a crime. Music is the sound of peace. It's one of the most beautiful forms of art.
This singer-songwriter is based in Tehran. That's why NPR has agreed not to disclose her name. In recent months, female musicians in Iran have been arrested and charged with indecency for performing in public. But for many years, releasing music on Instagram seemed like a loophole.
Whether you're an artist, run an online shop, even a repair technician, if you want to get noticed, you need Instagram.
From Persian rap to hard rock and electronica, Instagram is the platform of choice for Iran's female artists. Many have hundreds of thousands of followers. Most do not wear the compulsory hijab in their videos. But in the past 3 months, one by one, they've fallen silent. In December, security forces arrested 27-year-old Parastu Ahmadi and her bandmates after she performed a live concert on YouTube with her hair and shoulders uncovered. She was released on a $38,000 bail. Afterwards, during a broadcast on Iran's national TV, a child asked former parliamentarian Ali Motahari why women were not permitted to sing in public. He responded that it's not explicitly forbidden, but that women are largely not permitted to sing because Islam wants to, quote, protect the family. He continues, quote, any kind of action that causes the stimulation of sexual instinct is forbidden. The girls in the audience, all under the age of 10 or so, look nonplussed.
Your clothes was not good enough. Your hair was outside or you was moving.
These are all excuses, says Iranian singer Farahvaz. She was one of the first artists to gain a following on Instagram, but had to flee Iran in 2018 after being sentenced to a year in prison on indecency charges. Now she lives in Berlin and runs an organization supporting Iranian artists, The Right to Sing.
They are afraid. They know they are risking their life with singing and doing music, but they are like, if I don't do it, then what is the difference between me and a person who's not alive?
Objectively, she says, the latest crackdown has been particularly harsh. Even smaller artists who perform on social media only have been summoned for questioning and forced to delete their Instagram, sometimes their only link with their fans. The artist in Tehran says she and her friends will continue to make music, despite the risks.
Because there's no other choice. Half of society, us women, can't be ignored forever.
She says they're holding on to the hope that something will change. For NPR News, I'm Duri Buscarin.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Americans eat more shrimp than any other seafood, but Americans who catch shrimp are increasingly rare. They blame that on cheap imports and hope tariffs could help the industry here survive. Stephen Bisaha of the Gulf States Newsroom has this report.
Shrimping is not really the kind of field you just stumble into on career day.
You know, it's in your blood.
AC Cooper says it's a physical job. He could count back to four generations of shrimping in his family. He actually raised his kids on his baby blue boat, the Lacey K.
My wife was my deckhand, and would bring the kids on the boat, and I'd put them little plastic swimming pools, and they would swim in the daytime, and then at night, my wife would dry it out and put all three of them in it, and they would sleep in the little swimming pool under the bow, that way they wouldn't get wet while we worked.
The Lacey K is docked at a boat harbor in the Louisiana Bayou. Cooper says there used to be about 20 boats here. Not anymore.
We're on the end of the pier right where it starts at. And if you look down the pier, all these stalls used to have boats in them. These stalls used to be full. And if you look down them now, there's two boats that's tied up on the other side of me, and there's nobody else behind us. Nobody.
There were about five times fewer shrimpers in Louisiana last year compared to 2000, according to state data. Cooper says that's due to cheap imported shrimp. An investigation by the U.S. International Trade Commission found that Ecuador, India, and Vietnam subsidized their shrimp exports. That pushed down the price and harmed U.S. shrimpers. So the Biden administration put targeted tariffs on shrimp from those countries. And when Trump announces additional global tariffs, shrimpers like Cooper celebrated.
Oh, we're jumping. You know, we definitely support it. There's no doubt we support him 100% on this issue.
But limiting foreign shrimp could worsen a health concern that Americans already don't eat enough seafood. Experts say many of us who are not vegetarian aren't eating the recommended 2 servings per week.
We love our shrimp. We love our salmon. We eat a lot of it. We still fall short of the USDA dietary guidelines on seafood consumption.
Martin Smith's a seafood economist at Duke University and not a fan of tariffs. He goes as far to say that they could lead to more than higher prices.
You're going to drive down seafood consumption, and that's going to be bad for cardiovascular health and overall the health of Americans.
Smith says what often gets said when defending free trade, there are winners and losers. Gulf Coast shrimpers have been on the losing end of that equation for a long while. AC Cooper has been fighting for more than 20 years to change that, and now believes there's the right man in the White House to make it happen.
Hopefully Trump does it. You know, I voted for him. I voted for him the first time. I was a Democrat. I changed my party. I went to Republican.
One of Cooper's sons has already left the business. He said he could no longer support his family as a shrimper. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha.
Officials in Southern California are just now starting to issue rebuilding permits more than 3 months after wildfires destroyed or damaged more than 18,000 homes and other buildings. Climate activists hope to persuade people to go all electric instead of using climate warming natural gas. Now, that's in line with California's goals to reduce greenhouse gases. But NPR's Jeff Brady reports not everyone is ready to make that change.
In Altadena, California, these sounds are everywhere. Heavy equipment clears debris from the Eaton and Palisades wildfires, leaving a dirt lot for rebuilding.
We're on Glen Rose Avenue. Sorry, there's a street sweeper going by.
As the cleanup transitions to rebuilding, Jaime Rodriguez is in front of his burned home, looking where the garage used to be.
I had a classic BMW M Roadster in there. Unfortunately, I could only take one of the cars with me.
With the burned car hauled away, Rodriguez says he plans to rebuild a more climate-friendly, all-electric home.
No, there will be no gas in the next one. The only thing I had for gas in this house was just for the water heater.
Rodriguez started transitioning his home to electric before the fire. He replaced a gas furnace with a more efficient electric heat pump, and now he'll cut off gas service to his rebuilt home. That was an easy decision for him. But for people who haven't thought about switching to electric appliances, it's more difficult. A mile down the hill, past the burned elementary school, Lupe Sanchez's home was damaged but is still standing. She says switching to all electric never occurred to her.
No, I haven't heard anything about that at all.
Is gas service important to you?
Well, yeah, that's how I cook. That's how I had my dryer running, you know, on gas.
Natural gas is mostly methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. California buildings make up about a quarter of the state's climate pollution, much of that from burning gas. That's why the state has a plan to transition from gas to electric in buildings and zero out the state's climate pollution by 2045.
This has been viewed largely as a problem for the future.
Josh Lappin is a researcher at the University of Notre Dame who studies the expansion and contraction of energy systems such as gas utilities. He says across the country, these networks of pipes and equipment will have to shrink in coming decades to meet greenhouse gas reduction goals.
What a neighborhood scale disaster like these fires has done is bring this potential crisis forward into the 2020s.
And right now, regulators and policymakers are reluctant to force people who just lost their homes to also give up the personal choice to have gas in their new home. So for now, that's a choice being made house by house.
As much as I would love to see an all-electric future, I do think that's probably the right approach.
Becky Minton is the California director at the Building Decarbonization Coalition. To convince homeowners to rebuild with electric appliances, her group is providing information and technical help. One of the more compelling arguments is that electrification can save money.
Overall, we estimate that you can save somewhere between $7,000 to $10,000 by building an all-electric home as opposed to a dual-fuel home.
In part because there's no need to install gas pipes in the new home. That saves on construction costs. The local gas utility, SoCalGas, says it already has restored service to about half of the 30,000 customers affected by the Eaton and Palisades fires. Climate groups are talking now with people who lost their homes, so they understand early in the rebuilding process that they can choose all electric. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Altadena.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.